Who? Okay. Okay. So 90. Okay, I look at them. Okay, so let me start, and first let me recap a bit, okay, what we had from last time. Maybe if I put it like that, it might be as good. Because I rushed through the definition of spin for model, and I want to recap a bit this definition. So, we have seen that the definition of a spin form is defined. A spin form is going to be is defined as being first a two-dimensional cellular complex, and the coloring of S of this complex such that faces are colored by spins and edges are colored by intertwiners. And spin form is such that the boundary of a spin form is the union of a bunch of spin networks. And the coloring of the spin form induces a coloring of the boundary, which is exactly the type of coloring we had for the spin network, that is a spin on the edges of, so it's a union of different graph. And now a spin form model is a choice of local amplitude assigned to each type of neighboring of neighborhood of this 2D complex. So a choice of to each neighborhood of S. So for a neighborhood of a face, we assign a weight, which is a weight depending on the spin of this face. For a neighborhood of an edge, here E, which is the meeting point of several faces. We have an amplitude, which is depending on the intertwiner we put on the edge, and the spins of the face that meets along this edge. And then for a vertex, which is the meeting point of several edges, and also the meeting point of several faces, because it's a, you know, each edge that intertwines between is the boundary of faces. Then we have another weight, which is a kind of interaction weight, which depends on all the intertwiners of the edges that meet at this vertex, and all the spin of the faces that meet at this vertex. The blue one. You don't see the black?
I think it's totally blind.
What? Okay. So once we have this data, we can construct spin form amplitude, which is given a 2D complex, a coloring, and a choice of local amplitude. The locality is important. We could be the amplitude associated to a color complex or a spin form is just the product of all this local amplitude. Product of all face, product of all edge, and then product over all vertices. Okay, so we take our complex, we color it, and then for each substructure, for each neighborhood, we assign a local amplitude. And then Well, this spin foam, you know, is intertwining. So the spin foam is a singular surface somehow intertwining between, for instance, you know, initial and final spin network. And more generally, I have an initial graph, a final graph, initial spin network, final spin network, and a two-dimensional complex or spin foam model, which just is a cobordism. It's called a cobordism, which is boarding these two objects. Yes? In what? Here? Well, no, I'm supposed to keep track of this amplitude. So each, you know, I take a 2D complex. So now a 2D complex, a spin foam. So it's a 2D complex colored. So I have my 2D complex, and each face carry a spin, each edge carry an intertwiner, right? Given this data, I look at the product of all face, and I put here the spin which I have put on the face. I look at all edge, I put the spin that I that corresponds to faces meeting on this edge, and the intertwiner I have assigned to this edge, and the vertex also depends on, you know, the intertwiner of the edge meeting there and the face meeting there.
My question is, what amplitudes,
they're just numbers? They're just numbers. They're just numbers. Yeah, they're just numbers. Yeah. So far, they're just, yeah, complex numbers. So all these objects are complex numbers. And now I want to assign, you know, so, okay. So if I start, you know, if I want to compute the, given such a spin foam model, I want to use the spin foam model. The purpose of the spin foam model is to define the two-point function, if you want, or the physical scalar product. So if I, between an initial spin network, a graph with a coloring C0, and final, you know, between an initial and final spin network. And the idea is that I'm going to obtain this physical amplitude by summing over first all coloring of spin foam that intertwine gamma 0 and gamma 1, and sum over a certain class of 2D complex. So I'm going to sum over 2D complex and coloring of this 2D complex. The summation of a 2D complex such that the boundary of this 2D complex is just gamma 0 union gamma 1. And the coloring is restricted to be such that the boundary coloring is the coloring of the spin network. Okay? And the model I'm going to use is that if I sum over all possible 2D complex, it's a bit a wild sum. One prescription, for instance, that is currently under study is to sum under all possible two-dimensional complex, which are such that, let me say that, how I can say that. So given a two-dimensional complex S, I can define the notion of a one skeleton of this two-dimensional complex, which is just the subspace or the subcellular complex, which just corresponds of vertices and edges, and you forget about the face. So the one skeleton of a spin foam is now just a graph. Okay? So this one skeleton is just a graph. So S1 is a graph. Okay? Just corresponds of the vertices and edges of the two-dimensional spin foam. And there is a special class of graph where it's such that S1 is a... So a graph is called a tree if it doesn't contain any loop inside. Okay? So one particular summation, which is very convenient for many reasons and justified by the group fee theory, is the fact that you can take this summation such as S1 is a tree. Okay? So you take the summation over all possible two-dimensional complex which co-board an initial and final graph. And then for each two-dimensional complex, you sum over all possible admissible coloring. And if you remember this sum over all admissible coloring here, because the coloring corresponds, the spin, for instance, on the faces corresponds to the flux of area carried by the geometry. So this sum over coloring corresponds to sum over geometry. And that's the definition. The fact that you restrict the summation over 2D complex only to the one which are trees achieve two things. First, the summation is finite, so it's under control. And the second thing is that this amplitude do not depend on any particular subchoice of 2D complex inside. So it depends only on the boundary data. S1 is the one skeleton of S. Okay. So the one. Okay. You know. Here is. Let's say. Okay. Here's the basic example because it's kind of hard to draw complicated example. But let's say you know I've. Okay. At least it's a portion. So you know this is an initial graph, a finite graph, and that's my you know portion of my 2D complex. Now, S1 is just, you know, consists on the vertex and the tree. So it's just a four-valent graph here. And this object is a tree in the sense that it doesn't contain any loop. It could.
When you talk about the skeleton, you don't also mean the edges that are inside the border. You mean
no, I mean the
temporal edges.
Yeah, I really mean the edges of S, right? So I really mean the edges of S. The boundary spin network is really just part of face, right? It's just a face which is cut in half. So clearly, when this guy terminates, you know, there is an edge here of the spin foam, and it does, you know, this it bores it bores the face, and the spin network gamma is here.
Could you also okay. give an example with a loop plate?
So yeah, you could give an example with a loop. Take this guy and cap it up, for instance, with a, you know. Suppose I do that. So I start from the same spin network. Okay, is it? Maybe I should erase a bit, or be comprehensible.
So
I have a you know I have an initial small bubble, and then it recombines. Okay, so here the corresponding graph is going to be of that type. It's going to be a graph of five, you know, like a FIFO graph, which contains loops.
So is there a systematic definition of what
is S1? Oh, yeah. S1 is just the one skeleton. That is, you forget about the faces. That's it. So in general, when you have a notion of two-dimensional cellular complex, a cellular complex is defined in terms of object of dimension 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, glued together. And then when you have a cellular complex, you have the notion of the you know, zero skeleton, one skeleton, two skeletons. What?
Edges of faces are not part of the skeleton.
The skeleton consists of the vertices and the edges. One skeleton, okay? Anything which is zero and one dimensional. So a two-dimensional complex is obtained by having elementary building blocks, which are, you know, locally zero-dimensional, one-dimensional, two-dimensional, and you glue them together. And then you can, if you forget, if you glue together only the object of dimension 0 and 1, it's a 1 skeleton, 0, 1, 2, this is a 2 skeleton, et cetera, et cetera. So. Which one? Which edges? Oh, but this one was just a slicing. So this one is not part of the spin foam, right? This one is a face. So. Okay, so that's it. That's my one skeleton. And these ones are just also because I cut a face. It's a boundary of a face. So, you know, this is my edge. This is my one skeleton. I'm confused about. This is my one skeleton. That's it. And then, if you want, all the rest is. You know, all the rest is. I don't know, this is a face here.
So you only take the one dimension of things where there's more than two faces meeting?
I just take the one dimensional thing.
So
yeah.
It's like the trajectories of the vertices of your initial.
What?
The trajectories of the vertices.
Yes, exactly. Okay. I mean the spin form is defined in terms of vertices, edges, and faces. The one skeleton is just forget about the face. So it's a subcomplex. Think about of a graph. You know, if I have a graph, then the zero skeleton is the collection of vertices. If I have a triangulation. Well, if you want, they are. No, this is my edge, and the ends here are boundary of face. Well, this is part of my spin form, so it's just, it's not there. I just, it's to draw. You know, if you want me to draw something which closes, it's okay. If you want to be precise, you take your manifold. If it's closed, you don't have any problem. Okay. Now, if it's open, then okay. If you really want to be picky, but you know, you give me 15 more minutes. Okay. Or so you just take your object, and if it has a boundary, then you can decompose into its interior, right, which is an open set, and then you take the one skeleton, and then the boundary, and then you take the zero skeleton of the boundary, and then you take the union of the two. That's what you're going to do. Okay? Think about the closed graph for the moment.
Given two arbitrary spin networks, does there always exist?
Oh, yeah, of course. Given two arbitrary.
It satisfies your definition?
Yeah, that's the definition. Yeah. Spin form is a cobordism between two. Well, it depends. If I allow myself any type of vertices, yes. Now, if I look at only two four valents, then there may be some restriction. I mean, it depends on the type of restriction of the move you have. So, if you look only at four valent graph, I have to think. I think yes. Yeah, in general, yes. It's always possible. You know, the spin form can be arbitrarily complicated. So.
It can't be arbitrarily complicated. It's got to be a tree,
still. So. Yeah, it could have, yeah. You mean in the case of tree? So without trees, yeah. The case of trees. So if there's no. If you restrict to trees, yeah, there could be no. And if you restrict to a particular topology, then you get an amplitude which is zero. There's no move that can, you know, go from one to another, which is okay because this is the form. So why am I considering that? What is the property of that? And then I want to change is that at least in this context we're working Euclidean. If you take this definition, okay, here, then you can show here we're working some sense in an Euclidean framework. So I have the property that gamma in, gamma out is the same as the going from the empty graph to the union gamma in, gamma out. I don't have really a time ordering anywhere, so the amplitude I'm computing in this context, you know, the two-point function in-out is the same as that with this definition. And then I can compute the property of that. One of the properties of this means the empty graph, right? One of the properties of that is that I can define some type of Hamiltonian or evolution operator, which is in the kernel of this two-point function, or at least in the kernel of this object. So you can show, you can define certain operator generate the kernel of this two form. So let's. H gamma is defined to be, okay, so let's label, there's a bunch of, let's say, Hamiltonian, which are labeled by four, suppose I restrict to this four-dimensional spin form models, then you can show with this definition that for each colored four-valent vertex, which carry an intertwiner and four representation, you can define an operator which is the one which leads, it acts on spin network, one of the actions that there's a first term where it's just it reproduces the spin network, and then a second term, which is of the form n is the number of vertices of that type in the spin network, sum over v ae of iij kl times the spin network gamma, where at the vertex I've considered, I replace the vertex of gamma. So gamma somewhere is this vertex ij kl. And then I replace this vertex by a new spin network, gamma tilde, which is the same spin network, except that locally I blow this ij kl. Maybe it's not completely, sorry. Okay, times. Okay, I should have a bigger blackboard. So times the vertex amplitude, which depends on, you know, additional i's and I, j, k, l, and additional j's here, times a spin network gamma tilde, which is the same as the one I started from, but where I replace the original four-valent vertex by a four-valent vertex where I have added a small tetrahedra here. And the additional coloring that arises here is exactly the coloring that arises there. And there's a sum of all vertex of that type, and then a sum of all possible colorings of this extra tetrahedra. So I don't want you to, you know, we are not going to work with this formula, but I just want to get you to get a feeling that this amplitude starts to achieve part of what you wanted this year of spin form to do. That is, you wanted to be able to construct an object which somehow produces a scalar product compatible with some type of Hamiltonian evolution or Hamiltonian constraints. And here you see that I have an operator with graphically is an operator that, you know, H is an operator which looks like I take my vertex and then I sum over some spin and I blow up this vertex and I add another small tetrahedra inside. And the action of this operator on my spin network is such that when I evaluate them in my, you know, as in the scalar product, it gives me zero. Okay? So, this is exactly what I wanted to achieve in the first place, that is having something which doesn't depend on any extra data, but somehow solve the Hamiltonian constraints, right? Or if I call this object somehow the Hamiltonian constraints, or if I think of this object, this elementary amplitude move as being some type of unitary evolution, unitary time evolution, solving the Hamiltonian constraints, someone to say that, well, when I make a unitary evolution, nothing changed. That is, the state which is evolved unitarity with respect to the constraints has the same physical scalar product as the one which is not evolved. Okay, so you can, starting from this definition, you can start to study these objects and prove these identities. And maybe Etera is going to talk more about that. The main technical tool which is used in this identity is what I already mentioned, is the fact that here you see I was drawing pictures and graph, and in physics there's one place at least where we are used to, instead of doing computation, drawing pictures. This is Feynman diagram, right? And it turns out that this is not an accident. It is because the subjects here are exactly Feynman diagrams of very specific type of theory. And you can show, in fact, that any spin form model that you can write like that can be written as a Feynman diagram of what's called a group field theory. So even if you don't like this group field theory, you don't want to work with it, it's always in the background. And sometimes it's very useful to prove some identity there. And from the point of view of this group field theory, the restriction to summing only over tree amounts to restrict to the classical level of this group theory. The sum over tree level Feynman diagrams is the same as looking at classical equations of motion. So there's a correspondence between somehow quantum gravity there and some type of classical group phi theory. But I hope Etera will have time to explain a bit more this object. Okay, now I want to change a bit gears because so far it was very general. I talked about this amplitudes, and if there's maybe questions before. Yes. Oh, that's a complicated question. It's not completely known in generality. So there's some formal argument that you should expect a positive scalar product on the. So I don't want to talk about that. That's something which is at the edge, let's say, of today's research. You know, under what condition is asking. So here I've shown that in some sense you're solving the Hamiltonian constraints defined like that. So suppose your Hamiltonian constraint was defined like that in the first place. And one of the version of Thomas Hamiltonian constraint is exactly somehow written like that. Then you could start to try to use this technique to produce a physical scalar product that solves the constraint. But one of the conditions that you want to satisfy is unitarity, or another way to say, positivity of this physical scalar product. So here I've defined a notion which is a two-point function written as a sum of a Feynman diagram, and this is exactly what you do in phi theory. So in phi theory, you compute the S matrix. The S matrix is obtained as the sum of a Feynman diagram. If you really want to take the phi theory in the classical limit, you will just get the sum of a three-level Feynman diagram, and this is called the Hamilton-Jacobi functional, and this is really somehow your physical scalar product. So here, that's what I'm doing. The question is what are the proper choice of weights, you know, here, which are, I think there's several questions. The first question is, what are the proper choice of weights which are justified from some type of microscopical argument, right? That you start from theory and construct it, like what Thomas was saying, or you discretize the theory as I'm going to do next. So how do you choose these coefficients, right, with some reasonable physical input? And then what you also want to see is that the corresponding physical scalar product, which is solving your Hamiltonian constraint, is positive. You know, it has a kernel, but it should be positive. If it's positive, then it defines an Hilbert space on the space of a network. It defines a way to quotient your Hilbert space by the GNS construction that Thomas was talking about. So you define your physical Hilbert space, if it's positive, to be the kinematical Hilbert space generated by spin network divided by the kernel of your two-point function. Okay? And if it's positive, then you have a unitary representation of your algebra of operators on this object. And in some sense, you can claim that you start to have an Hamiltonian, you know, formulation of a theory of quantum gravity. So there are lots of loopholes, but you get the general picture there. Okay? And part of it is research. So here I'm going to focus on now one example where I can effectively do completely the job. So there's only one theory so far that we know how to solve completely, exactly. And we have a microscopical justification for this choice of weight, and we can show it's positive, and we understand the physics. And we can even go further. We can couple quantum gravity to matter, and I hope I can do that, which is a three-dimensional gravity. So now I want to go back to a very specific example, which is the example of 3D gravity, and show you how you can construct a one spin form model, which gives a complete solution of a theory of quantum gravity. And maybe I should justify a bit that, because my sensation is that after the talk of Carlo, people have remembered one thing, is that but what he says is that you should not do a 2 plus 1 quantum gravity. I'm sure, you know, he wanted to say something else. But so why is it interesting? I think it's interesting for a very simple reason I was saying that at lunch today, is that it gives you one example of a complete theory of quantum gravity. Very simple, very simplistic, in some sense, but a very concrete example that you can start to look at, try to deform. You can try to start to do geometry with that. You can start to understand what it's telling you. For me, it's a bit like a Lobachevsky plane. You know, people were wondering, is it possible to relax the fifth axion? And, you know, one day, one guy find this very simple example. And then, you know, 100 years after, we had Riemannian geometry and et cetera. So in some sense, the 2 plus 1 case is the quantum Lobachevsky plane. It's a typical, it's an example. It exists. It is there. It's consistent. And we have to study it. And it's the, you know, simple example of what a quantum dynamical geometry looks like. So I've been advised to be very gentle with this blackboard. That I was a bit too violent. So I'm trying to repress myself and do it very gently. It kind of work, but okay. Trying to tame the... Okay. So... Where's the... Okay. So, 3D gravity. So I'm going to work with 3D gravity in the formalism, in the first order formalism. That is, the geometry is written in terms of a Wirbein field, which is a one form valued in my Lorentz group, or the covering of my Lorentz group, which is, I'm going to be Euclidean, so it's SU2. If I wanted to be Lorentzian, all the formula I would write would be the same, except that I have to think about this one form to be a SU1 form, right? I mean, SU2 is just the double cover of SO3, and SU1 is the double cover of SO21, which is the Lorentz group of 2 plus 1 gravity. Maybe another remark about 2 plus 1 gravity is that if you try to do that's what Rutter told us yesterday, if you try to do, you know, renormalization group with 2 plus 1 gravity, renormalization group in some sense do not care about the dynamics. And if you try to do that with 2 plus 1 gravity, you will find out that this theory is non-renormalizable. And you will have to generate this infinite number of terms. And maybe it is asymptotically free, but the difficulty of showing that in this context will be as hard a priori as in, you know, proving that 2 plus 1 gravity is asymptotically free is an open problem in the sense of, you know, trying to do what Martin and Robert Pekarski are trying to do. It's a very hard and open problem. Here, what we're going to do is find a solution of 2 plus 1 gravity, show that there's a unique way to quantize the theory. It would be interesting to see how these two things manage. So in some sense, you're going to see I'm going to derive the solution in a very, very, very simple manner. But if you take another starting point than spin form model, then this problem becomes extremely, extremely hard, right? But it will be still, I would be very interested to understand what does it mean from that's a question for you. What does it mean from the point of view of this asymptotic safety scenario, for instance? So there's a Wirbein field and there's a connection form field. Okay. This one, yeah. Okay, here. Okay, so this is a SU2 value connection. Are you sure it's the one which you can erase after?
Yeah, try more because it's brand new.
Okay. Okay, and sometimes it's convenient to use a basis of Pauli matrices, so E is just EI contracted. With GI, where GI is epsilon IJK satisfy the Pauli algebra with a factor 2, that is the trace of GI. GJ is delta IJ. Okay. The action of 2 plus 1 gravity is very simple, so 1 over 8 pi G here, integral over M, epsilon IJK. EI wedge F GK of omega, where F is the curvature. And then if there's a cosmological constant, there's also a term EI wedge EJ wedge EK. Okay. And we're going to work in the context where lambda is equal to 0. So we are going to ignore this term. The story becomes much more complicated if you include it, but it's very, very interesting to include that. By the way, one of the biggest problem of one of the most, you know, biggest problem of quantum gravity, at least for certain people, certain community, is called the cosmological constant problem. It's the question: how does the vacuum energy of a theory gravitate, right? And this is a question that exists in 4D, but it's as puzzling in 2 plus 1. So if you claim that you have a full solution of 2 plus 1 gravity, you should be able to answer this problem, which is one of the major puzzle of theoretical physics. So I, you know, encourage you to think about that in this simple context. If you solve that in this context and you propose a solution, this is an extremely big result. That is, you will have lots of people interested in what you have to say. I'm going also to... Well, that's why I call it GI, so that I get no I here and everything is okay. Maybe you want to minus? Okay. Good. So I'm interested also not only in gravity, because I want to know what type of geometry this quantum gravity is doing. In order to do that, the most efficient way I know is really to try to look at the coupling of matter fields to gravity. And instead of trying to couple matter, I'm going to take the point of view that quantum field theory is a second quantized version of a relativistic, a bunch of interacting relativistic particles put together consistently. So I'm going to look at the coupling of gravity to a relativistic particle. That is, on top of this object, I'm introducing an action for the particle, which depends on an extra momentum. There was a position of the particle, and then there is an intrinsic metric on the particle. And the action is the integral over the world line of the particle times pi ei of t, so lambda over 2 p squared minus m squared, where ei over t is really ei mu x dot mu. Okay. And lambda, okay, and then dt if you want. Okay, so this is the particle in world line formalism. If I was Lorentz, so here I'm going to do some quantum, you know, Riemannian quantum gravity, that is exponential IS, and I'm going to couple to matter. Really what I'm interested into is the Lorentzian one. In that case, this is really the action I'm looking at. But I'm extending this notion of relativistic particle to the Riemannian case, where I just take this similar action here. And I'm going to go on. So if I look at the equations of motion, for the combined coupled system,
what is P?
P is the momentum of a particle. Momentum of a particle. Momentum of a particle, yeah. This is Px, you know, integral P dot x. This is, the relativistic particle has a position and a momentum, they are conjugate variables, and this is the coupling to gravity. So this is the standard relativistic particle coupled to any. It has nothing to do with 3D gravity. We write down the. So this is the coupling of. This is a description of a relativistic particle propagating in an arbitrary background manifold, arbitrary background metric. Coupled to gravity. So this object imposed in the first order formalism. Okay. So if you want to write it in your usual way, you just P appears quadratically here, so you can integrate it out if you like. Right? So unshell lambda P is equal to ET. And then if you plug it back, you get the action that Jan was talking us about, which is just the length, the world line of the particle. But let me write it in first order, because path integral is always defined properly in first order. And if you try directly in second order, you can get confused. I started at 5:10, so it makes half an hour I started. So
it remains your
future? No. No. I started at 10 past 4.
Okay.
So.
8 minutes.
Well, in 8 minutes, I will. So I'm not sure, even sure it was not 15 past 4. No. Okay. So the equations of motion for this system are first that the torsion is 0, the omega is equal to 0, and then that the curvature, I should find a natural stopping point. The curvature here is proportional to the moment of the particle because E is coupled to the curvature there. And Fi, okay. So along the wall line, okay. So outside of the location of the particle, this tells me that omega is just the spin connection. And the geometry is flat outside the location of the particle. And then at the location of the particle, I have a delta-like singularity, which is, in fact, a conical. It's going to be a conical singularity. So to see that this describe a conical singularity picture, conical means that, you know, away I'm flat, so I'm living on a cone. And if I'm here locally, I don't know what's going on. I'm just in flat space. But if I look from above, what's really happening is that at the tip of a cone, there is a particle. And the amount of angle of deficit angle, which is here, is proportional to the amount of momenta that I've, my particle is carrying, or the mass that the particle is carrying. So to see that, let's just write down the solution. It's good to show it once, so you can see that. So let me go on. And okay, I'm going to specify my notation to GM G0. So let me take a metric which is D of this function, where G0 is just G in the direction of the time, and G phi is cos phi G1 plus sine phi G2. Okay, my polymetric.
What?
What?
Just after D.
It starts with?
D.
Yeah, D of that. T is the time, T times G0 plus R times G5, okay?
This is a plus, no subscript.
No subscript, plus R, sorry, plus R times G5. Okay, if I compute the metric associated to that object, you know, I'm going to get DT G0 plus DR G5 plus R dot G dot phi, et cetera, et cetera. That's going to be a metric which is dt square plus dr square plus, if I put the coefficient right, just 1 minus 4gm square r square d phi square. Okay, so when m is equal to 0, this is just the flat space metric. And the flat space metric is flat just because E can be written as D of something. And now the subject here, the only difference is that now I have some amount of curvature which is given by that, and which means that if I try to look at the holonomy around my particle, I'm not going to find 0, but I'm going to find something which is proportional to the momenta of the particle. Here it's mg0 because I work in the case where pi is a static, so pi is m0, 0. So if I work in the frame where the particle do not move, I see only the mass of the particle. This is the metric. To see that this is a conical singularity, you see that if I define a new angle, phi tilde, which is 1 minus 4 gm phi, then in terms of this angle, this object is just the flat space metric. Right? It's the flat space metric, except that now the identification is that phi tilde is identified with phi tilde plus 2 pi minus 8 pi gm. Okay? So it means that I'm looking at a portion of flat space in coordinate r theta, And instead of identifying the this line with the line from 2 pi, I identify this line with the line which is at an angle 8 pi gm. So I'm constructing a cone, and that's the metric of a cone. Okay? And you can check that this is a solution of these equations of motion. I'm not going to do that here. Let me just, before, okay, I want just to finish now with the analysis of the classical theory, and the next time I will just quantize it and discuss all the property. One important thing for this theory is to understand what are the symmetry of the theory. So there's two types of symmetries, in fact, three types. So the first one are gauge transformation. That is Lorentz gauge transformation, which are of the form delta L of EI. They are labeled by a Lie algebra element X. They have the form E dot X, commutator, delta of E, delta XL of omega. There are d omega of X. So this is the usual gauge transformation. And then there's an additional symmetry in the system, which is responsible for the fact that there is no local degrees of freedom. It's called translational symmetry. It's a symmetry that is also labeled by a Lie algebra element. Let me call this Lie algebra element phi. Delta E of phi is d omega of phi, and delta of omega is equal to zero. So you can see that this is a symmetry, because if I plug this variation in the action there, I'm going to get a d omega of phi. And if I integrate by part, I'm going to get a d omega of f. D omega of f is identically zero by the Bianchi identity. Okay? So this is called Bianchi identity. Now, usually in gravity, we don't talk about this translational symmetry. We talk about diffeomorphism. But in some sense, this translational symmetry is just the fact that locally, you can always think about diffeomorphism as being some type of Poincaré type of gauge symmetry. In general, this is not an exact correspondence, but in 2 plus 1, this is an exact correspondence. So in order to see that, there's another symmetry, which is, of course, diffeomorphism. And this symmetry is not independent from the others, but you can show that they are labeled by a vector field xi mu, and you can show that the diffeomorphism, the action of diffeomorphism, which is just the Lie derivative action, is equal to a combination of Lorentz gauge transformation with the parameter, xi mu omega mu, plus a translational part with the parameter xi mu e mu, plus a term which are zero on shell. Okay. Combination of the curvature, if you want. So essentially, the translational symmetry, you can think of it as being on-shell equivalent to diffeomorphism symmetry. Just to finish the structure of the theory, the canonical structure is exactly the same as the one described by Thomas in 3 plus 1. And that's why we can use exactly the same sets of techniques. It's amazing at this level how similar these series are. E and omega. So I look at E and omega now pull back on a two-dimensional surface. And let me call the two-dimensional index A. EI omega GB is delta IJ epsilon AB, where this is the two-dimensional epsilon. This is the Poisson structure. And now the physical phase space, that is what? Is the physical phase space P is the space of solution. This is absolutely general for any theory. Physical phase space is the space of solution divided by, gauge symmetry. So if I look at the configuration part, the fact that I have this structure tells me that I'm going to look at wave functions, and I can look at wave functions that are functions of the connection, SU2 connection. okay? And then I can use my spin network basis to describe this object. So the states are functions of the connection. The space of solution, suppose I forget about the particle for a moment, is just, you know, F equal to zero. So this is a flat connection. So I'm looking at a SU2, you know, SU2 flat connection. Modulo the action of gauge transformation. And it has a name, it's called the moduli space. So it's a space of homomorphism. The space of flat connection has a name, it's called the space of homomorphism between the pi 1, this is the space of non-contractible loops in my manifolds, into SU2, divided by SU2. If you don't know that, it doesn't really matter. It's a moduli space of flat connection on my initial surface. Right. If I start from a manifold, which is from sigma across an interval. But this is only half of it, because I also to take the other condition, d omega e. But if I look at an infinitesimal variation of f of omega, this is just d omega of delta of omega. So the full phase space p is just now, in fact, a cotangent bundle, which is the cotangent bundle of the moduli space of flat SU2 connection. Okay. So one way to quantize gravity on such type of cylinder in the Hamiltonian framework is first to do the reduction, and then quantize this object, which is a finite dimensional object. This object is a symplectic manifold. It's a cotangent bundle. And you can do it. Or try to do it in a way that is similar to the one you would do in 3 plus 1, that is not solve the constraint classically, but use this spin network basis and try to construct the corresponding spin form model and dynamics. And that's what we're going to do next time. OK.
Since, again, we don't have time, let's make a break, but make it shorter.
Well, we started, yeah, more than 10 minutes, so I'm not even late.
No,
I'm not late.
You're late.
No, no.